Well, good evening, Ole. It's good to talk to you finally. I hear you've been pretty busy on the road lately. Care to share that with us?
Yeah, for sure. I've been on a 15-day very intense tour in Denmark, Sweden, Norway, and Germany. And it was a trip with very mixed emotions because I had some quite serious threats before and warnings as well going back to Norway, where I've been before, looking into the mass shooting on Utøya and the blowing up of the government building in Oslo, and also in Berlin, since I've been part of raising big questions around the Holocaust and the numbers that, when you really look at it from a researcher's point of view, does not make any sense at all. And what is so weird is that today in Germany, if you publicly or if you raise questions about this, just questions, you can be arrested and put in jail for several years. So, it was interesting, but everything went really well.
You know, when I was posted to Italy, we spent time in Germany, and I took the opportunity to visit Dachau. Here's my big question here. I don't know, but you see the films, you see everything where all these people were going voluntarily with the German army, handing over their children, handing over their wife. The parents handing over the children. I don't get it. I never have got it. They'd have had to shoot me.
Me too, but this voluntary thing, I've never seen that. I've seen them being forced to do it. But I'm looking more at the pure physical evidence that is there and also the numbers that greatly exceeds what would be physically possible to do. And also when you look at the official numbers of these concentration camps, it goes down from, in some places, down from 2 million down to 78,000, where most of them died from starvation and typhus. So it really, when you look at it more and more with an open mind, then it's the official story about 6 million doesn't match up at all, at all.
Well,
Anyway, but
leaving Germany, let's get to the beginning of your trip. I was interested in the threats. What kind of threats did you receive?
No, the thing, there was a warning about going to Berlin because they said if I go there, I might be arrested. But I think I'm totally in love with truth, and the reason for that is that it's so simple, it's so pure, so clean. It fears no investigation, and you can have a really lousy memory and still live free because you don't have to keep track of things. And this is why, since I've been so much involved in exposing conspiracies and false flag operations and so on that are covered with lies afterwards, the truth will lead you to the real event, whatever happened. So this thing in Germany about that, I think just because you're not allowed to talk about it, that makes it even more important that we do it. Because like Voltaire said, if you want to find out who controls you, find out who you're not allowed to criticize. And I think at least we should be able to openly just question things, like with everything else, put a question mark if it doesn't match up. Let's look into it, and then the evidence will show whatever the truth is.
Well, in the Dachau area, there's a town not far away. There's farms all around. People would There's a main road that goes past the camp. They had to know. They had.
What we're being told happened, yes, for sure. But let's go back to Copenhagen, is that where I began. It was the Open Mind Conference this year, and it was for me a really, really special one. It was the second year I was invited, and I had the immense pleasure of doing an interview, like what is called the reality talk, in front of the audience with Judith Vary Baker. For those who don't know about Judith Vary Baker, she was Lee Harvey Oswald's girlfriend or mistress, during the months upcoming to the assassination. But she was also very deeply involved with creating a bioweapon against Fidel Castro based on a cancer virus called SV40, financed by the CIA and other, a massive big operation.
Wait. You're saying that she worked for the CIA?
She was recruited into this operation without knowing it.
Wow.
She was only 19. She had the highest IQ in Florida, and she was the person in the U.S. that could make cancer cells grow faster than anyone else. And that got people in the dark corridors of power very interested in her, because they saw a possibility to create this bioweapon against Fidel Castro.
So that brings a new light into everything, huh? Not really new, because it's been around a while. And I understand that she's going to be at a conference that's coming weekend in New Orleans.
She is indeed. I would so love to be there, but I can't make it. But because the whole thing is that through her testimony, it's suddenly the whole JFK assassination comes into a totally new level of understanding, because Lee Oswald was also involved in this bioweapon project, but on a very low level. He was there to take the different samples of cancer cells from laboratory to laboratory to laboratory, and he was also the one that was appointed to deliver the finished cancer weapon to Cuba. This is why they were preparing him to look like a pro-Castro individual, so that he would be able to get a visa, so that he could get to Cuba and deliver this this weapon. But while this whole thing was taking place, it was him, Dave Ferry, Jack Ruby was involved as well to some extent, and other people. But in the same circles that was involved in this, you also had the circles of people getting focused on trying to eliminate Kennedy. And this is how the whole thing goes into the Kennedy assassination, where somebody found Oswald as the perfect patsy to be pointed out. They could control him all the way up until the assassination itself, and then control his death and elimination as well.
You know, in 1983, just after the Grenada invasion, I made my first trip into Honduras as we were recruiting Contras. One of the people working in the arena is an old, I guess, boss of mine named Ted Shackley. And he had some off-the-cuff remarks. He never really said anything, but he had some off-the-cuff remarks about Kennedy and about the assassination.
And about his body, I'm sure.
Yeah, and you know, Shackley was one of the main operators who was running the whole plan to invade Cuba. You aware of that?
Yeah, and so much more.
And he was so angry when the program was cut and all of these guys that he was training, they were killed, you know, in the invasion because of the non-support. He was so angry. He got what he deserved, is all he said to me.
Mm. Shackley was also very much involved in Operation 40. It was him, David Ackley Phillips, and E. Howard Hunt. They were the people recruiting the people into this ultra-secret hit team. And Operation 40 was later super central in the JFK assassination. So he was very much involved in that one and many, many, many other operations.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, he was Deputy Director of Covert Operations for the CIA.
Yeah, for the Western Hemisphere.
Uh-huh.
So big player. But I also believe it was him who, I'm not sure who he said it to, but someone overheard it, that he said that the JFK's body had been dumped out at sea, which I believe is true. I think there's an empty grave in Arlington with that flame on. I do not believe there's anybody there.
seems that they're pretty adept at dumping things at sea, huh?
They do indeed. They like that. And it's so odd because such a thing that sounds so outrageous. I mean, when I look into other major top assassinations, I think we're seeing more than one empty grave around the globe, I tell you, because there's a very similar pattern of how they get rid of evidence, including the body as well.
Just in case somebody comes up with the idea.
And
some who were never actually killed just moved. I have several instances where we moved top-level personnel that I thought had died years before in and out across the Canadian border into the U.S. and back out again for high-level meetings. So, you know, that was part of my tasking when I was stationed and posted up in upstate New York on the Canadian border.
Well, Chip, you know I'm always an eager listener. If you want to tell me about these things ever, I'll tell you.
So it's not the 25-year mark yet, but it's coming very soon.
I know. 2017, I'll be at your door knocking.
Okay, don't let me interrupt you. You were on a good run there.
No, and it was really interesting. There was Mark Devlin there, Frank Rasmussen from Denmark. There was Johan Oldenkamp from Holland and other people. Ken O'Keefe was there as well. So it was a really good conference. Then I made my way up through Sweden. I did the three different talks there and also a guided tour around the site of the where Olof Palme, the Swedish Prime Minister, was said to have been murdered. That's a between five and seven hour walk. I take people around there showing what I believe actually happened based on what witnesses saw and the evidence I collected over these 30 years. And I've had it confirmed from several people that have joined me on this, one of them being a South African colonel who had worked with some of the people that was taking part of this operation. He said, you're spot on, but he said, be aware, not a lot of the people who appointed these people are still around. So it is a tricky area. I mean, you, if anyone knows this minefield you get yourself into.
Well, especially, and when you're dealing with the folks that North and the others dealt with.
Yeah.
Folks, you're listening to Ole Damegaard. Ole's a friend for years, and Ole's website is lightonconspiracies.com, right, Ole?
It sure is.
He has great information there, has his books there, so feel free, lightonconspiracies.com, feel free to visit there. He also has podcasts available for you to listen to. Well worth your while. Let's get back to Sweden.
To Sweden. I also want to say that after 25 years, I've finally got Coup d'etat, my book Coup d'etat, up on Amazon. It's in two parts, and it's about the assassination of the Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme, but with all the connection into the whole international illegal arms trading, including the Iran-Contras, the Freemasonry, also with direct links back to the JFK assassination and so on, where there were actually some people that were part of the thing in Dealey Plaza also on location 23 years later in Stockholm. So it's an absolutely incredible story, also linked into the sinking of MS Estonia, a ship between ferry that was sunk between Estonia and Sweden, killing almost 1,000 people. So it's a real mess.
As one starts to investigate, you can start seeing where entities tie together. And folks, let me tell you, it's a very, very small world when it comes to the world of professional assassins. So it's not as the ones who are good and the plan, and it's several levels. It's not only the assassin himself, but it's the planning. When you have planning operations, tasking, funding, it's quite a small group that can successfully run this kind of wet op.
Thank you so much for confirming that, Chip, because that is my conclusion. I keep running into the same people again and again and again and again. And I heard an interview with one guy who was involved in this, and he was asked, but why do you use the same people? And he was just laughing and said, why change your winning team? I mean, if you got the best, why change it? And it seems like this is the way they've been using it. And one of the people that keep popping up is your old boss, Bush Senior. He is just all over the place when it comes to these things.
He's an evil dude, bud. I'll tell you that.
He is an evil dude. I have not met him, but I always wondered how I would react if I would shake his hand or not. You know, like if he reached out his hand, if I would shake it. I don't know. I really.
I don't know. I don't even know if he's able to even lift his hand any longer. My sources tell me that they don't think that he'll make it past the new year. So we'll see.
Well, anyway, I don't envy him coming up and knocking on the door. I don't know who it is you knock on the door, who opens the gates to heaven, but I would not like to be in his shoes.
I don't think that that's going to be an issue.
Oh, I think he's going somewhere else.
Yeah, ooh. You know, I don't... having a father, now, as a father myself, having a father, and, you know, this family is historical, folks. It goes way... It goes back. It goes back to Prescott, and even before Prescott.
Yeah.
With these, I don't want to use the term Illuminati at this point, although the term exists. Hey, it's getting such a common fare that even in a auto commercial explaining the use of internet systems in cars, in the commercial itself, they talk about the Illuminati. So. Folks, there's reason that that name is being put out there more and more. It comes in a couple great motion pictures. The knights are in the motion pictures, so it's becoming more and more. And this is the way ops work. You want to start acclimating people to certain things, and so you do it slowly. And it may take years, but they have years.
But also I think that they put it out there to discredit people like us, you know, because like, oh, come on, you watch too many movies, you know, yeah. But I really think that is how they do it as well. They put it out there to diffuse it. Once it's too late that they feel that they cannot keep it quiet anymore or keep it hidden anymore, then suddenly they take a step forward and start exposing, but very little of it, just leaking a little out there.
Just a little bit at a time, acclimating, yep.
A little bit at a time. And there's one thing I wanted to ask you, Chip, because it's like it's like almost they're showing trailers of upcoming events when it comes to big false flags or big so-called terrorist attacks and so on. Like 4 or 5 years ahead, boom, it's right there in front of our eyes. And then a few years later, the real bang is carried out. But I've been told that the reason they do that is because they know the law of karma, and they know, and it, according to them, if they show their victim what is going to happen and the victim does not react to it, then the karma is on them, and the people behind it can wash their hands and move on. Is that something you know anything about? Because otherwise, I don't understand why they're doing it.
We would never... On the assassination side, we would never first assassinate a person. We would always confront them verbally, give them the opportunity to conform, and if that didn't happen, then we would carry out the assassination of that person. Thus, hey, he had the chance, and you're exactly right. Takes the onus off of us. Puts it right on to the target.
So that is the way they argue that he's had his chance, and if he didn't take it, well, it's up to him.
Yeah, you know, personally, as a combat man, I'd rather just fire first.
Yeah.
Instead of approaching an unknown entity, and you know, you never know how they're going to react. for me, look, if you guys want to kill him, just let's just do it. That was always my attitude, but they said, no, we have to do this, and they pushed, we have to do this way. And that makes sense that that's why. They never told us that's why, but that certainly falls in line with their operational procedures.
Interesting. Because it's like the next place I went after Sweden was to Norway, where I've been there now two times, really looking into trying to discover what actually happened with the mass shooting on this beautiful island called Utøya, and also the blowing up of the government building in central Oslo on the July 22nd, 2011. And that is just one incredible event that absolutely no one touches. I don't get it. As far as I know, we're only three people that are really digging into it. Three, and we're looking at the biggest mass killing officially by one person since the Second World War. And it's just unreal.
Well, what there were, if I'm thinking back, there were like seven people dead in the explosion.
There was eight people officially dead in the explosion, and 69 on the island, 69 teenagers.
Uh-huh. And then Oslo is a beautiful, beautiful area.
It is. This island is about an hour's drive northwest of Oslo, out in the countryside. Absolute stunning area. But the whole thing, the more you look into it, I've been giving public talks about it now here the last few months. Some of it will go online hopefully very soon, where I go into great detail about what happened and what did not happen. Because there is one man that I really really admire. His name was Fletcher Prouty. He was one of your former colleagues, I think. I don't know if you've ever met him, but he worked in the CIA way up and in Pentagon as well. And he became a whistleblower after the JFK assassination. And one of the things he said with Black Ops is that don't just look at what happened, look at what did not happen, what did not work, you know. And this is where we come back to every single time where there's these big operations, suddenly all cameras are shut down, bodyguards are pulled away. All type of normal logic is delayed until whoever carried it out are out of the way, and then boom, in goes the whole team, very efficiently looking in all the wrong directions and pointing out the patsy.
Right, we would always use misdirections in entities, always, and especially in an operation of that size.
When you say misdirections, how would that how would that show itself?
Well, for example, we would. I'll give you a real good example. In Cambodia, across town was a radio transceiver. We went over there, and the explosion there preceded the true attack onto the airport. That pulled the police and pulled everyone into that area to see what was going on there, leaving us more free to complete the actual operation. That's done in it's very difficult, especially today, with all the cameras, with all the social media and everything, to get away with something without providing a diversion of some sort first. So you always want to provide that diversion for your primary forces.
Yeah.
Whether it's a physical diversion or just mentally through media planting information. Mm. It's the diversion, and you see that today with all the alternate media out there. There's a lot of diversions, you know, out there trying to pull away from the truth.
Anyway, I went there on the anniversary, the days before the anniversary this summer. I went to Norway, and I gave a talk in central Oslo, very close to the government building, actually, just a few hundred meters. It was very discreetly called Political Assassinations and False Flag Terror. And in the audience, somebody pointed out that there was people from the PST, which is this Norwegian security police. And I welcome them because I think these people are very often duped and not aware of what it is they're protecting. So they, if anyone, needs to get informed because they're protecting the whole thing. So, but then the following day, I went out together with a Norwegian alternative journalist. We went out to that island, and there is a little ferry. It's a long story, but we were trying to get this little ferry. It's only 600 meters across to the island, and we were standing there waiting for to get across, and there was absolutely no one there. We were the only ones there, and we stood there maybe waiting for 15, 20 minutes for this ferry, and then suddenly a rubber boat arrived, you know, full speed with two police officers, Norwegian police officers, that jumped out and came running up and confronted us and wanted us to identify ourselves. Anyway, to make a long story short, he got my name, and then one of the guys went away, came back, and then he said he had been talking over the radio. And then he said, Ole Damegård, he named me right there. Ole Damegård, a decision has been taken. You're not welcome here. You are free to leave the area on your own, or you will be arrested. And he also said that Danish and Norwegian police have nothing on you, but we are aware of that you've given talks connecting some assassinations and so on, saying that they are connected. He said that everybody is free to have an opinion, but this type of thing is not welcome here. So
you didn't have a backpack with you, did you?
No. No backpack at all. I was just standing there, really, you know. And that was a bit surprising. I mean, we were just there, out in the middle of nowhere, wanting to take a ferry, and suddenly I was informed that Danish and Norwegian police had nothing to do on me. I was a bit surprised that a Norwegian police officer would have any knowledge what they...
Well, they have the Interpol contact, but because they're...
Like a really cool individual. So he said, but
well, just like I said, because they're two states together, it's like Florida, Georgia, you know, the Florida, Georgia line. So what you get, excuse me, folks. What you get is you get information sharing across the border very easy. I've got you. You're back on now.
Okay, so where did we
lost you. We lost you at you were surprised at the Danish and Norwegian.
Yeah. Anyway, so my friend, the Norwegian journalist, he's a really cool, laid-back guy. So he said, "But listen, okay, now you know who we are. Who are you?" And he said, "Do you mind telling us your name?" And the Norwegian guy just backed off and said, "Absolutely not." And he said, "Well, do you mind if I take a photo of us?" And he went up to sort of take a selfie of the two of them, and the police just backed off, you know, and said, "You know, stop it." And then he said, "The only thing I can tell you is my service number." And that service number he told us was Delta 031. And for me, that was like, whoa, wait a second, because the Norwegian Delta team is extremely involved in both the thing that happened in central Oslo and on the island, being the team that were there to take care of the shooter under Spinning Breivik, but was delayed for more than 1 hour while he was walking around executing people. And while Anders Behring Breivik, or whoever was doing it, he called into the police and got hold of someone connected to the Delta team saying, "My name is Anders Behring Breivik, I'm Commander Anders Behring Breivik, I'm operation almost complete, I would like to surrender now to Delta team." So the Delta team is very, when you look at this whole thing, they are all over the place. And suddenly I was standing looking there into the eyes of someone that someone that might have been directly involved in this whole operation. And I later identified him. He was actually in the Delta team. He was the second one that got on the island, and he was actually the guy that put the handcuffs on the shooter. But
you ever wonder
what he was doing there?
No, the Delta. You know, just for example, what's the symbol for Delta?
It's a triangle.
It's a triangle.
It's a triangle, isn't it?
Yes, it is. We have Delta units around the world. Funny that Delta is used in those entities, and their triangle, which ties right in to another entity.
It
huh?
is indeed. It is indeed, especially when it comes from you. But anyway, after that, they told me to sod off. We didn't do that. I mean, we left the area, but we just went up the road, waited until they left, and then we went back. But the second time now, when I got back, before that happened, I received an email because I'd exposed this guy on some interviews with his not with his real name, but with this Delta 031. And then I received an email saying from someone I thought was a friend, but I know he's working for Special Forces and so on. And he said that I would not label this person as Delta Force. I'm reading now from his email, because these guys operate in the background and you cannot distinguish them from other armed men. Delta Force refers to members of the U.S. Army Special Forces Unit, Special Forces Operational Detachment Delta, SFOD-D. They would never talk with anyone on site, even if you could see them. And then he says, there are kill teams well above SFOD-D that operate in the dark and light. If I cannot actually see them, I'm careful to label their presence. Now, please, Chip, tell me, what is that? The last sentence, to me, that sounds either like a friendly warning or a subtle threat.
Did you ever see the Jason Bourne series of movies?
I did a long time ago.
Mm-hmm. You recall how the intelligence entities have personnel placed in areas around the world?
Yeah.
The wandering assets.
Like sleeping agents, that type of thing.
Well, they're very active. They're wandering assets, and they're used. Quite often, highly trained, not the same training, not the same as what you see in the movies, but they're highly trained assets in all areas, whether it be to incite riots, to blackmail, to cause issues within a country, or to assassinate. Highly trained assets sit around the world in the dark. Just waiting for the call.
Is that, because I don't understand, there are kill teams well above SFOD-D that operate in the dark and light. What does that mean, in the dark and light? Is that exactly what you're describing now?
Right. In the dark is ultra secret.
Okay.
And in the light, not so ultra secret. Different one who operates per se in the dark isn't shared. If you're operating in the light, like when we would be assets working with Israeli commandos, Danish, Turkish, whatever, those are our light assets, and the dark assets are never shared, so that no one would have access to them.
So
only a single entity.
So how would you interpret this last sentence? If somebody wrote that to you,
it's definitely a threat.
Okay, thank you. No,
from where, you know, and by who, you know, I would have to.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't
just
know.
That, no, this is a guy who's deeply involved in these type of things. It's not a secret, but it was just like we were talking about a Norwegian police officer, and suddenly he talks about kill teams, and I thought, well, that in my world is a threat. Even if it's a friendly threat, it's still a threat, you know. So, anyway.
Yeah, and he sh- and And, you know, that kind of a threat, using the dark and the light, putting that out there is, I would never do that, but, you know, that's me.
Yeah, exactly. But anyways, so I heard it loud and clear, but I just felt, okay, fine. So what I did was I went out in a few interviews and exposed this email and said, you know, like what was going on and so on, and also saying that instead of going back there giving one talk, I was going to give two talks instead, so that there would be a chance for friends and families and so on of the victims to for the first talk to spread the info, and then have a day in between to get that going, and then have a second day where I would do the exact same thing, exposing totally, not totally, but to a large extent what happened there. And so that is what I did. But I must say I was a bit concerned when I flew into Oslo, because I did not know who was waiting for me there.
I can see why. Yes.
Yeah, it is.
However, having made that person having made that threat has not done the organization well, simply because he didn't follow through with it.
No, exactly. And I thought what came up was that this guy who worked and still is working extra, as far as he says, for special ops in the U.S. I think he's in Miami or in Florida now. But it said he said that service numbers are never given out. And then he says Delta 031 wasn't even a call sign, which I'm also never given out. He gave this number to throw people off. It means nothing operationally. But that one just got me really like threw me back, because I thought, how the hell does this guy know what Delta 031 was in that operation in Norway? How can he know if he was not part of it? So that was a bit of an eerie experience to see that. Because the more I...
Well, what you also have out there today is you have those who were adjoined with operational positions who are no longer adjoined. We call them the wannabes or used-to-bes,
yeah.
Who go out and actually pose threats. I know Lorian Fenton received several threats from a ex-MI6 asset out of England that we had to take care of pretty quickly. Because he was positioning himself and making threats to people, and whether he could or could not carry out those threats, it didn't matter. He wasn't aligned any longer, so he was just a rogue. But he had enough information and had enough background and had enough contacts to be a threat.
No, so what I did was when I gave the two talks in Sweden, two of the talks in Sweden, I pointed out and identified this Delta 031 guy with name and number and a photo, and just said, if anything should happen to me, please go and visit this guy and ask questions. And I also said that if I, by any chance, to just simply be quiet, it would only be because somebody close to me, a loved one, had been threatened or so on. That would be the only reason. But so anyway, I went to Oslo, I went to Norway, and everything went fine. And I did the talks, and I was very pleased with that. But one thing that is so odd in Norway is that there's no reaction from the families. It is just totally quiet. Nobody's reacting. And we're talking like more than 77 victims in this whole thing. And it's only 4 years ago. And nobody is reacting. Nobody is standing up. Nobody's yelling out, you know, crying for or screaming for another investigation. It's the official story being pumped up on a weekly basis again and again and again and again, and then nothing else. But also, Chip, if I can use this time to ask you a question, because I went to the prison where Anders Behring Breivik is held, It's just outside a town called Skien, and it's in the outskirts of an industrial area. And the prison, I was expecting to be, you know, high-tech, you know, heavily secured, lots of cameras, barbed wire, these type of prison. It was so lame. There was hardly any cameras. Very, the wall was very low. Inside, there was only a few buildings I've seen on Google Map, but it's very tiny. And around it, there was an area about 10 yards on the outside of the wall where the grass was dead. It was brown. Anyway, my friend who took me there, he said that he was, he said, come, I'm going to show you something. And we walked along the wall and so on. And when we walked close to the wall where the grass was brown, I started feeling physically ill. There was something like a very odd feeling, you know, almost like when you go close to a high voltage type of thing around my
throat. Right, and that's exactly what they do. They put those kill zones in, the dead zones.
Please, what is that? What is that?
Can be a huge area of electromagnetic cables underground, and that's what kills the roots, kills everything. If they flip the switch, it's always on, but if they flip the switch, you're gone.
So it's a kill zone outside. Is that what you're saying?
Sure, it's a kill zone.
Okay. Why did I feel ill? Was that from the magnetic?
Well, they have to keep it charged.
Okay.
Otherwise, to turn on and turn off the equipment, it takes such a long time to get it on and off. So it's always on. It's just at a low level.
So if anyone tries to get across the wall or near the wall, they can just switch it on, and boom, we're fried potato.
Turn it up.
That's
it.
Thank you. Anyway. I remember you telling me that you used to fly these black helicopters. You used to fly people into what you call the famous doctors. I think it was in Missouri or somewhere, into a prison thing where they did their
Springfield, right?
Springfield, Missouri, where they did their thing with them, and then you got them out of there. But If I also remember right, you said that often there's an airstrip nearby needed without a flight tower, or at least that would be handy, and that these people were being flown in and then transported in and out of these different facilities without nobody seeing what's going on. Is that correct?
Sure, absolutely correct.
Okay, and also that there are some, when there's companies around these facilities, these companies are often front companies that are run by the agency and so on, that could be into internet security or telecom or what do you call it, body armor, these type of companies. Is that correct?
Proprietary companies,
Yeah, okay, so when I came to this area, I right away felt this is exactly what Chip told me about, because the companies around, it was very secluded, this area, there was not a lot going on, but the companies around, no people, but companies exactly like the ones you described. So I asked my friend, is there an airstrip or airport nearby, a small one? He said, yeah, it's right there on the other side of the hill. So anyway, he said, there's one thing I want to show you. And we went up there, there was this small little, it was a company where it said auto import, and then a phone number, not Oslo auto import or Skien's auto import or Hugo's auto import, just auto import and a phone number, totally neutral. And that really made me sort of like, whoa, wait a second here. Behind it, there was a building with no windows and just six carports. And so Then on the side of it, there was a container, a big container that had been painted the same color as the building. But behind it, behind the building and almost up against the wall towards the prison, I mean, we're talking 30 yards more or less exactly from the building to the wall, there was a massive big container, green, and it said evergreen painted on it.
Our old boys, huh?
Your old boys. Thank you for confirming that as well. Because on it, it also said U.S. import, blah, blah, blah. I took the serial numbers. I took photos of it and everything. I just felt, oh, my God, I'm standing right in the center of an operation like the ones you described. Here we have...
Yeah, and probably there were tunnels going from there across into the prison, too.
Well, I did not figure that one out, but... So what would you think that that company with these six carports, what would that be?
You know, Norway is a good jumping off point for smuggling arms. Remember, we tried to use Sweden.
Yeah.
You have Bofors, which produces used to. I don't know if it does any longer. Produces some of the most advanced arms in the world that can be moved easily over to Norway and on out. So if Norway is providing end user certificates, that would probably be a very good zone for that. Also, you can use prison labor is great too, isn't it?
Anders Behring Breivik, this guy that is said to have done this mass shooting, I mean, there's witnesses that said they saw up to five people in police uniforms walking around with automatic weapons killing these people. So he's just the one taking the fall for it. If he was involved or not, I'm not totally sure. Because I've got four different photos of him right when he was arrested, then when he was held in custody in one of the buildings on the island, then the guy they showed all the evidence in court, the photos on his police tag, he was dressed as a police officer, and the one in court, they do not look alike. So I'm really wondering what it is we're looking at here. But
who's really behind those walls, if there's anyone?
If any. That is my exact point, because I don't think he's in there. Or if there's anyone in there, I'm confused. And the more I look into it, the more info I get that this was a joint operation by the CIA, the Mossad, and MI6. These are the ones that keep popping up here, with the backup of course, of Norwegian forces and Norwegian Freemasonry people in the key position that are covering the whole thing and stopping any investigation into it. But Chip, can I ask you about another thing? Because the explosion in central Norway, they say that it was more or less identical to the one in Oklahoma City. Absolutely not true. And by the way, the Oklahoma City is another major one that is not like we're being told. But what the evidence in Oslo shows is that it was an implosion, not an explosion. It is very, very odd, because people very close to where this whole so-called bomb went off did not hear an explosion. But people some 200-300 meters away from it, they heard what they thought was like a thunder, like a... Not a big bang, but they had like an air impact, like 2-3 seconds before the sound came, even though the distance was very short. And people 25 kilometers away could feel both, they could hear, feel the impact from the so-called explosion and the sound, but not the people that where it happened. And also... All the buildings around, the glass was sucked into the streets, not blown into the shops away from the explosion. It's totally the opposite. And
called it implosion, huh?
Implosion, exactly. Implosion, and there's, I identified a handful of people in both uniform and civilian clothes that are wearing identical suitcases. Also, there's some right after the so-called explosion, like the whole area was closed off. It seems like, and there were a few real victims on one side of the government building, and then crisis actors on the other side. But just after the so-called explosion, there are five soldiers, military police soldiers, Norwegian ones, that come running and tell the camera crew to just sort off, and then they're very busy collecting a white cable from the street level. There's also a dog ditch that was like a road work that was all the way along the street going up to the government building that was there for some five, six months beforehand. And they say that they were left there because they wanted to dig down some sensors that could check if a truck with a bomb came. Like, I don't know how you can tell the difference between a truck that is loaded with a vegetable and a truck that is loaded with a bomb. But they said that these are the sensors that they wanted to put down there. But when they dug down, they got down to a level where there were some very secret cables going into the government building. But that ditch, whatever was dug down there, and that electric cable, these suitcases were all involved in sort of making the target area for this implosion. Is this something you know anything about, these type of weapons, whatever was used? Are you there, Chip?
High energy. Yes, I am. I am aware of some of our high energy weapons. That almost sounds like some type of magnetic or impulse devices that they would plant to mark an area, whether it's to mark an area to be void or mark an area to target. It's hard to say. Years ago, we planted or we tested our high energy weapons off of satellites. We tried to bounce off of a satellite out of Space Command and hit a dead satellite that we had. We missed. And when we bounced off the satellite, it bounced back to Earth and it hit a zone in Colorado in the Rocky Mountains, and the evergreens in that area were all laying on the ground in the same direction, like a huge tornado came through and just wiped them all out. Thousands of acres of them, all laying in the same direction, and the explanation was a big storm hit. Come on.
Was that the trees that lay in the same direction?
Huge evergreen trees, yes. Where the energy weapon actually imploded into the zone. Wow. So I can believe, and that was in the, I'd say, 80s.
Yeah.
So I can believe we advanced to the point that we can target better now with our high energy weapons, and you still need to mark your area, just like with our laser weapons. We paint a target. Those suitcases could be painting the target.
But what would be in these suitcases?
Oh, it could be any kind of transmitters for an electromagnetic weapon, something to mark the zone. That weapon would either come from an aircraft or would come from a satellite bouncing. So you have to target your area, and they would be targeting devices.
And what would the cable do? Would that be part of creating the target zone as well?
It could be. I haven't a clue.
No.
On the cable, I know that the portable devices would be more exclusive for targeting in an area. Yeah.
But what this whole thing about the only glass being sucked out, nothing in the shops, in the shop windows, there was nothing else being sucked out but massive amounts of glass. And there were some people that were part of the operation that was on, they were in the target area, but just dressed with helmets and visors before, you know, like glass shields before in front of their face. So this, it seems like the buildings were lifted and shaken more than they were being hit by
or sucked Just like laying everything in one area was like a huge suction that just pulled them over to their side. Animals, the people in Colorado said animal life wasn't affected by this. So, you know, sounds like one of the energy weapons.
And I'm so grateful that I can ask you these things.
Remember, glass isn't a very, you know, it's very limber. I mean, it can be pulled easily, broken easily. Whereas a building, you know, it's not going to give so well. And once you like in a hurricane, once the suction is done and the air is able to pass, everything's fine on that building usually, once they suck that window out. So, you know, you'll get some moving around inside, but not much.
Yeah, that's exactly the case. But what is very odd is that they've left these buildings for 4 years, not renovating them, not doing anything with them. They're there like a monument of death and destruction. Just the buildings are there, but all the windows are blocked with, you know, like it looks like Louisiana when the tornado went through there. What would explain, why would they leave the buildings for 4 years?
I have no idea.
Would there be some,
Insurance?
no, but would there be any toxicity? I don't know how you say that.
Toxicity?
Toxicity,
You know,
or
depending on the weapon, there certainly could be. There could be any number of things, depending on the type of weapon and what propulsion was used, what was in those suitcases. You know. It's hard to say, and it could be that they don't know. So, moving into the more of a safe entity, abandon them for a few years and see and do testings in the soils, in the air, and everything else. Look, when you have a huge suction of air like that, you're pulling a lot of stuff out of there, you know.
Well, it sure is an interesting case, that's to say the least. Anyway, after that, I went to Berlin, where I was invited to a covert human harassment conference. It was me, there was, I'm sorry, I forgot his name. He's a really, really skilled professor, very much into HAARP and other stuff. He's from Alaska, Nick Beijing? No. And John Hall was from the States, Kevin Barrett was there. Ole Johansson from Sweden, myself, and there were some people from Czechoslovakia and Poland and so on. And it was a really, really interesting experience, an emotional experience for me as well, because I have never been, I've never met people who have been exposed to these things. Where they claim to be part of mind control operations or victims of it, or and sort of like the what is normally called MK Ultra things and so on. So it was very odd for me to meet and see the pain in these people, because I thought to start with, my God, I'm in a room with absolute lunatics. I mean, I did not. It was very hard for me to take it seriously, and then. Over these 2 days and where we were there, I was shaken, really shaken.
Well, and let me jump back a second. Remember what glass is made of? It's, you know, basically silica, and they could have magnesium, aluminum, lead oxides in them, that could be heavily affected by something magnetic in some instances. So it's hard to say what kind of weapon they use, but even iron is used in some windows and some glass to strengthen it and to give more reflectivity. So it's hard to say.
That's so interesting, because no, even paper was still left inside the windows, you know, paper stand, all of these books, nothing was affected, but just glass thrown in. And also from, but from the government buildings themselves, all the windows were sucked out. I mean, it was not that close to the explosion that was more damaged there. Absolutely not. It was the whole whole area, 15-story high building, all the windows out, and then evenly spread out. It was not that there was an epicenter where the explosion was, and then it was thrown out from there. It was just evenly sucked, like just like you say, sucked in. And,
yeah,
and also the people that were part of the with the crisis actors, you know, the people running around looking like firefighters and ambulance drivers and so on, many of them had the same blue latex gloves on.
Mm-hmm.
Question mark again. Why? Well, I guess you can't tell. Or maybe it was just the glass. I don't know. It was just these blue gloves are everywhere. And when you look at the photos, the different photos.
It sounds like a sucking effect or an implosion that pulled everything into the center, to the.
Would that make sense with the sound as well? Why was there no sound in the center of the whole thing?
It's like in a hurricane, you know, there's no wind in a hurricane in the eye. So
yeah.
Depending on what weapon they used, you know, and like you say, those briefcases, suitcases, it's hard to say. Having been gone for so long, but I can tell you now that they have had to have perfected some of those weapons that they were testing back in the 80s that I'm aware of. So.
Well, if you know one about anyone who's good with implosion weapons, I would be very much interested in getting in touch with them to learn more.
I will do that. Look into my little black book.
That sounds good.
Well, Olive, we're at the end of the hour. I want to thank you. Can you give your website and everything out?
It's light on
quickly for the folks.
lightonconspiracies.com, because there's more than one, and what I try to do is totally non-violent but fearless exposure through pointing the light right at these dark areas to expose what is actually going on. And as I said, my book is finally up there on Amazon.com. I've got four of one, but the ones most important in this area is Coup d'etat in slow motion. Coup d'etat in slow motion. And I just want to thank you, Chip, for giving me this space and inviting me, because it's always extremely both an honor but also extremely interesting to talk to you, because you come from a point from the inside where the rest of us are fumbling in the outside in the shadows trying to figure out what the hell happened, but you have so much inside knowledge, and through your courage and bravery being part of exposing this, it's such a gift for humanity, I would say, that you do this.
Well, thanks, Oli, but I'd rather be on your side.
Yeah, for sure.
On the outside, looking in, trying to figure it out.
Yeah, but you used to be there, so...
On the inside looking out, yeah. I was there. That's right. Okay, sir. Thank you, my friend. And we will be back, folks, next Wednesday on the Hump Day Report. Me and the camel. Good day.
Good day.
Okay, we're good.